From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Hillary Clinton today is clarifying her pledge from NBC's Commander-in-Chief forum last night that she would not put ground troops into Iraq ever again. Pushed on that by reporters, Clinton reiterated that promise, but also said this.
I support the air campaign. I support special forces. I support enablers. I support surveillance, intelligence, and reconnaissance.
Both Clinton and Trump spent half an hour last night answering questions about the military, national security, and veterans from NBC's Matt Lauer. And Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh with MIT's Security Studies program is here with some analysis. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. And what are your thoughts generally on that forum last night?
Well, I thought they both gave some good answers to particular questions. Obviously, they both had problems, very different kinds of problems. I think Secretary Clinton at times falls into that habit of being sort of part lawyer, part policy wonk. I'm not sure if some of her answers really connected with voters and viewers. Mr. Trump had very different kinds of problems, a very good communicator, but then would sort of undercut himself by saying things that could be described only as bizarre. So they both had strong moments and they both had weak moments.
Well, let's get to the moment that we just heard about at the top there, Hillary Clinton making a promise that she would never put troops into Iraq ever again. Let's listen here to her speaking.
We are not putting ground troops into Iraq ever again, and we're not putting ground troops into Syria. We're going to defeat ISIS without committing American ground troops. So those.
What do you think of that, Jim, especially given the fact that there are still American troops in Iraq on the ground?
Well, it was a surprise for me. I sort of took a step back on that one. She's noted for her caution. I did not expect for her to make such a flat statement. It might be an attempt for her to shore up support among the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party, who fears that she is more hawkish. Mm-hmm. And she got a question in the forum directly on that from that perspective. There is also a little wiggle room here. It all depends on what you mean by boots on the ground. She, in her answer this morning, excluded special operations forces.
Uh-huh.
And so part of it is how you define it. But there's no doubt that she has staked out a position and it's going to narrow her options.
Well, and on the issue of the Iraq war, Donald Trump criticized her for her vote for the war and said again, as he has throughout the campaign, that he was never for going into Iraq. Here he is last night.
I happened to hear Hillary Clinton say that I was not against the war in Iraq. I was totally against the war in Iraq. You can look at Esquire magazine from 2004. You can look at before that. And I was against the war in Iraq because I said it's going to totally destabilize the Middle East.
Now, as Clinton pointed out, though Matt Lauer notably did not point out, Trump did say he supported going into Iraq at the time. Here's one instance of that on the Howard Stern show. This is on September 11th, 2002.
We have an idea who the enemy is, and a lot of times the politicians don't want to tell you that.
Are you for invading Iraq?
Yeah, I guess so. I wish it was. I wish the first time it was done correctly.
All right. Are you still against rebuilding the World Trade Center?
I'm not against rebuilding it. I guess the hype.
Trump saying one thing in 2002, and now saying something completely different. But he also said last night, Jim, that the U.S. military generals have, quote, been reduced to rubble. What did you think of that, and especially with so many members of the armed forces in the audience?
Well, I think that on that topic in particular, on, quote, the generals, unquote, he was sort of typically a Trump, if I may say. He was sort of all over the map. He was, they're rubble. We need to replace them. I want to consult them. I have a secret plan. I know more than the generals, but I'm going to consult with the generals about my secret plan. I think we got lots of different answers depending on what the question was.
And what about the issue of Vladimir Putin, Trump reiterating his praise of Putin, saying that Putin has great approval ratings, more than 80% approval. Approval rating and great control over his country.
Well, if listeners could see me now, they would see me shaking my head. All right, you can have a view about Putin, but there's no world leader that would say that stuff out loud. We have allies. We have our NATO allies. We have people in Ukraine. You know, Russia having invaded Ukraine and Georgia, arm in arm with the war criminal Assad in Syria. Even if you believe that, you don't say it out loud because you freak out your allies.
Hillary Clinton got into the issue of going into Libya. This is obviously something that has dogged her for some time because of what happened in Benghazi, but what about that question now looking back and people saying we shouldn't have tried to topple Gaddafi? What do you think as a security expert as you hear that now?
I think it's a really tough question. And it depends on how you evaluate. Some people evaluate things by consequences. You just look at what happened. Other people look at what was the decision at the moment you made it. If you thought Gaddafi was going to massacre, you know, some huge percentage of his population, was going to commit this atrocity, then, and given the limited options, you might feel that it was still worth it because, yes, Libya's a mess, but, you know, Gaddafi was going to go at some point. You know, he's always going to be, you know, it would always have been a mess. It sort of requires that you guess what the history, what the future would be, and it's just very hard to know.
That's Jim Walsh here now, security analyst and with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, the debate at the top of the ticket can filter down. In Missouri, a state that's tilted red, Republican incumbent Roy Blunt is facing a challenger, the Democratic State Secretary of State Jason Kander, and it's a race that's closer than many thought it would be. That's where we're going for today's Senate Tracker, our weekly look at Senate races. Peggy Lowe is investigations editor at Here and Now contributor KCUR in Kansas City. Peggy, Roy Blunt looking for a second term, but again, it's close. So how much does that have to do with the top of the Republican ticket?
Well, that's a very interesting question because the Democrats obviously are trying to link Roy Blunt to Trump, who is unpopular for the most part across the country. The Republicans, too, then are trying to link Jason Kander to Hillary Clinton, very, very unpopular in Missouri. So while that's happening along party lines, here in Missouri, the two candidates are kind of trying to stay their own course. So, for instance, this race was so tight that both candidates stayed away from their respective parties' national convention to stay home and campaign, and both are crisscrossing the state in their big Greyhound buses and really trying to get out the vote right now.
Well, and that could also be because they want to distance themselves from those unpopular candidates. But start with Roy Blunt, promising to repeal Obamacare, reduce environmental regulations so that more coal can be used. He's also talked about military issues, his support of a bipartisan bill called the Military Family Stability Act that would give military families more time to relocate when they get stationed in a new place. That's mentioned in one of his recent ads. Let's listen.
Military families are put in situations where they have to be strong. Senator Blunt took a real issue that families face and he brought it to the forefront. And it didn't matter the background of the family, it didn't matter the political views of the family.
And Peggy, though, how important is this that Roy Blunt reached to that audience?
This is a very critical issue here in Missouri because Jason Kander is a former captain in the Missouri Army National Guard. He has a stellar record. He has released his military records to the public. He served as a lawyer and in intelligence in Afghanistan. His ads are gorgeous. They show him in uniform and helping. He still trains soldiers. So Blunt, actually, he took a couple, I think three deferments when he was in college in the 60s. So this is, you know, usually it's the Republican candidate who is really cited heavily with the military. Here in Missouri this year, it's the Democrat.
Let's listen to a little of Democrat Jason Kander's ad, again, talking about some of his military background.
I'm Jason Kander. I enlisted after 9/11 and was an Army intelligence officer rooting out corruption in the Afghan government. When I came home, I worked to reform state government, save tax dollars as Secretary of State. Now I'm running for Senate and I approve this message because there are too many politicians in Washington who only care about themselves.
And so, Peggy Lowe, what else is Jason Kander speaking about?
A lot of the other issues are things like the environment, as you mentioned before, Robin. You know, this is a big ag state, and Roy Blunt is endorsed by the Missouri Farm Bureau, which is the biggest, most powerful farm group in the state, and he opposes these environmental regulations. He opposes the EPA sticking their nose into farmers' business. That's a huge topic here. Jason Kander, however, is trying to take the race and move it more towards Democratic issues. For instance, minimum wage is a big issue because he does get support from the labor unions. And when polled, what's interesting is Blunt was ahead of Kander in polling about 5-6 points. But when asked about the minimum wage, Kander polls higher than Blunt. And so some national activists and certainly Missourians here on the ground see that as a great issue for Jason Kander.
So it's shaping up to, I mean, it's this really tight race. And we understand tons of money is pouring in from outside the state.
That's right. For instance, with the military ads that you were just playing, a group called One Nation, it has anonymous donors. It spent more than $3 million in Missouri on a version of these ads touting Roy Blunt's military family experience. So there will be a lot of outside money. So far, Blunt has raised more than Kander. He's raised about $9 million. Kander's raised about $5 million. That said, the experts here say the race is expected to top the $39 million mark that was spent on the last Senate race here that involved Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill.
And in that case, the Democrat did win.
She sure did.
Yeah. In this red state, Peggy Lowe, investigations editor at Here and Now, contributor KCUR in Kansas City. In our weekly Senate tracker, she's looking at the race between incumbent Roy Blunt, the Republican, and his challenger, the Democrat, Jason Kander in Missouri. Peggy, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
In thinking of the 15th anniversary of 9/11 coming up this Sunday, we went back to the very first in 2002. We spent the week in New York then, a year after terrorist manned planes crashed into the Pentagon, a field in Pennsylvania, and the World Trade Towers. Jim Gartenberg had been something of a sentry on 9/11, reporting from inside Tower 1 while he was trapped until his voice was stilled. A year later, we visited with Jim's widow, Jill, and their little girl. We start there. Our 2002 visit, and Jim's reporting on WABC News.
On the phone, we have an eyewitness, is that correct?
Yeah, Jim Gartenberg joins us. He was on the 86th floor of, I'm not sure which tower, was it the east, north or south, Jim?
It's the World Trade Center 1, and it's not was. I am here, and I'm stuck right now.
Now, are you above?
My husband's name was James Michael Gartenberg. He went by Jim Gartenberg, and he was on the 86th floor of 1 World Trade Center.
A fire door has trapped us. Debris has fallen around us, and part of the core of the building is blown out.
Jim,
actually, a friend of mine had called me on my cell phone and said, Jill, I just heard Jim on TV, and he sounds great, and he's going to be okay. And I said, he's not going to be okay. I knew he wasn't going to be okay. I knew that he sounded calm and in control because that's just always how he sounded. But I knew what was going on in there, and I had walked out of my office to look downtown, miles downtown, when I saw the smoke and the fire that was coming from those buildings. I couldn't imagine anybody was going to survive that, even if the building didn't collapse, which, of course, then. So.
After Jim died and the tower collapsed, Jill became one of 100 widows expecting a child. In 2002, she was raising 3-year-old Nicole and 6-month-old Jamie, who was born half a year after her father's death.
She's named after my husband, who's James, and right after your daddy, in his honor.
Do you have a sense of what happens now?
Okay, sweetie, I'll get it.
The ice cream, let's go. Get the ice cream.
Okay, you know what? Let's leave it like this. What's this?
Do you know what we call these little things where we're from? These little things, you know what we call them? We call them Jimmies.
Who's Jimmy? Our daddy? Is that your daddy? She's too busy eating.
He's still my daddy.
He's still your daddy. That's right. He'll always be your daddy.
Well, and you have that 24 hours a day.
Yes. Every day we talk about daddy and we watch videos about daddy, right? Mm. Nicole loves to watch our wedding video.
Mommy and daddy.
You want to watch it now? The mommy and daddy video with you in it?
Yeah.
Okay. Daddy. I had been initially in my office when I got his initial phone call and phone message.
Tuesday, 8:48 a.m.
We played that recorded message in 2002. Jill has asked us not to play it today. It is excruciating. Jim is frightened. There's fire. It's not the brave face he put on for his public TV calls that prompted hundreds to write letters to Jill after he died. It's what Jill heard when they spoke privately that morning. What did you and he get to say to each other that you can...
How much we loved each other and how much he loves my daughter. You know, what do you say? What is there to say? I spoke to him 5 or 6 times. What else is there to say when I know he's not coming back home? And thank you, sweetie. Nicole brought me a tissue. This is where we started a home together. Life has to go on.
Hi, it's Daddy.
Oh, it's Daddy?
On a toy phone.
Yeah, she does that all the time. It's her way of talking to him.
Daddy, hi, Daddy.
Yeah. I'm looking at these letters. This man writes, so calm, so reassuring. I heard him speak of where he was, trapped. I was wondering, could I be half as brave as he was? He left quite an impression.
Mm-hmm. That's right, he did.
Our visit with Jill Gartenberg in 2002, again her husband Jim, died in the World Trade Towers in 2001. And we've reached Jill today in New Jersey, where she now lives. Jill, we've actually chatted a little before. We sent you that tape so that you could hear it. You told us you bawled. I can't imagine what that's like for you to hear that.
You know, I've done several interviews over the years, but this audio piece really was something, you know, different than anything else I'd remember doing. And it's very emotional because the raw aspect of it, when you hear Nicole as a little girl a year later still calling her daddy on her toy phone, it's just a very emotional piece.
Oh, well, I mean, it was our privilege to be there. But what happened after that? You were saying life goes on. I mean, we met a woman in your apartment lobby who came up to you and said, you know, you're my hero. Jim was a hero to so many, but you were too for your soldiering on. Was it always soldiering on? Or I'm wondering if there were times when you just felt you couldn't move.
I don't remember a moment I couldn't move. What I remember is right after 9/11, I remember being up all night long looking at pictures, making new photo albums, just kind of, you know, making the memories last as long as they can last and having proof of that in the beginning. And honestly, you know, I went back to work soon after. I was pregnant. I had a little girl. You know, we had to move on with our life, and that's what Jim would have wanted.
Of course, what made everyone so proud of him was his extraordinary phone calls from the towers to local news. You had very different calls at home. You know, he was frightened. And we're reminded you weren't the only one to hear from a loved one. I can remember the woman who was speaking with her teenage grandchild who was on the plane that we all knew at that point was going to crash in a field in Pennsylvania. You know, it was inevitable. And she stayed on the line with this grandchild as that happened. Are you part of a community still?
Yeah, for better or for worse, I'm definitely part of a community, and my kids are part of a community. My kids are growing up with thousands of other kids who lost a parent that day. And, you know, it was, I would say, a national tragedy. And I think it's important to keep telling the story, especially for the younger generation.
Well, it's funny because, you know, we've chatted in email, and I told you that we have a wonderful colleague. She's 20-something. She went in the archives, found this story for us, listened to it, and turned to me with tears in her eyes and said, I just didn't know. I mean, she knew intellectually about 9/11, of course, but she didn't know until she heard you.
Right, and I appreciate that sentiment. I mean, right now, kids are learning about it in school. It's history to them. It's so hard to kind of explain what we were all feeling that day for those of us who remember.
And I want to know how you are, how your daughters are. You mentioned Nicole. We understand that Jamie, who was born 6 months after 9/11, became the last of the children of the 100 widows who were pregnant to be bat mitzvahed, you know, at the age of 13.
Right. You know, new life with, you know, other life missing a part of the new life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think Jamie and Nicole are testaments to moving on and, you know, achieving as much as we can achieve, keeping his memory alive, but making him proud, even though he's not here to be with them.
At the time when we spoke, I asked, was this a burden? Because people, they almost needed for you to be well so that they could be well. Complete strangers. Is it ever a burden to be the 9/11 widow?
I wouldn't say it's a burden. I would say that my loss is very public. People have loss and tragedy daily, and it's not public, and people don't always know the anniversary and where they were when that tragedy happened. This one, everybody who remembers that day feels a loss that day and feels the tragedy, and I think in a way I find comfort with that. And I wouldn't say look at it as a burden. I think that it's something that we just need to constantly talk about. and share with the world what that day was for all of us, not just those of us who had an immediate loss.
And what about your new life? You are now Jill Gartenberg Pila.
Yes, I remarried 12 years ago. My husband also lost his wife. Not 9/11, but he also lost his wife. And so he knew what loss was. He knew what that kind of loss was. He had two children, and I had two children, and we have four children now. Yeah. And we've made a new home and a new family for them. And I can tell you that our children are happy and, you know, really doing great. I have to say, from the time my now husband and I met, we always said our previous spouses are pulling strings from above.
Well, Jill Gartenberg, now Jill Gartenberg Pila, we wish you and your family a peaceful Sunday, this coming Sunday.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I appreciate you reaching out.
I'm on the 86th floor on the east side of the building facing the East River.
And what time did you get?
If I'm on the air, I want to tell anybody that has a family member that may be in the building that the situation is under control for the moment and the danger has not increased. So please, all family members, take it easy.
Jim, in one of our producers.
The voice of Jim Gartenberg speaking from the doomed World Trade Center towers on 9/11. By the way, he was scheduled to move the next day to a Midtown office. He died in the tower collapse. We visited his widow, now Jill Gartenberg Pila. It's Here and Now.
The NFL season kicks off tonight with a marquee matchup between the defending Super Bowl champion Denver Broncos and the team they beat in February, the Carolina Panthers. And as the season gets underway, there's a lot of attention on what happens during the national anthem and whether all the players will stand. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And before we get to the NFL, I just want to ask about something that just happened today. Ryan Lochte, the swimmer, banned from swimming for 10 months because of the gas station incident in Rio where he said he was robbed, and then that turned out not to be true. Your thoughts on the 10-month suspension?
Well, the reason it's 10 months is that that extends through the championships in July, so he won't be able to swim in world championships. And, you know, that hurts the United States to some extent, but I think it was a just punishment in terms of comparing it to, say, the soccer player Hope Solo, comparing it to the international incident. He lost a lot of endorsement money, so maybe he'll be able to move on in about a year.
Okay, what about the NFL? What should we be watching in this Super Bowl rematch tonight?
Defense. These are two great defensive teams, but I think what everyone wants to watch is the Broncos quarterback, Trevor Siemian. He's played one snap in the NFL, did not do anything except kneel with that snap, and so he replaces Peyton Manning, slots in. Oh, that's all. Those are the shoes he has to fill. Broncos have a great defense. We'll see what he does to maybe get that offense up to snuff. And the Panthers, they were upset in the Super Bowl, but they're still, by most people's accounts, not favorites to go back this year because some people think that their quarterback, Cam Newton, outperformed what he has normally done in NFL seasons past.
And speaking of quarterbacks, New England's Tom Brady is suspended for the first four games because of Deflategate. How much does that hurt the Patriots this year?
I was just checking the odds, and so a good site that I use, which is Football Outsiders, calculates their odds of making the playoffs at 66%. In years past, it was upwards of 80% to begin the season, so it hurts a bit. And another data point is they opened the season in Arizona, and they are 6-point underdogs, a little less than a touchdown. So that doesn't seem huge, except that's the most they've been underdogs by since 2009. So yeah, it has an impact, but they're still likely to make the playoffs. So when they do, Brady will be under center.
Mike, this year, Los Angeles is going to have a football team, the second biggest media market in the country. The Rams are back in town after leaving St. Louis. Do you think LA is going to embrace the Rams?
I think they will. I think it's, you know, obviously a huge town, the second biggest market in the United States. That was actually one argument against them getting a town, because TV ratings would be great in L.A. if you could play whatever game you wanted to play. But there were more Rams fans, L.A. Rams fans, waiting to come out. Or maybe there are just more newspapers doing stories on them. But there were more blue and yellow Rams fans than I was aware of. So I think they'll do pretty well in L.A. in terms of appealing to fans. In terms of winning football games, not so sure.
And just briefly, do you expect other players to follow Colin Kaepernick's lead and not stand during the national anthem to protest police violence against African Americans?
I don't know. One of his teammates did. I think this story will subside. I don't know that Kaepernick will stop. But, you know, as games are to be played, there's more to pay attention to. And the definition of news is that which is new. So if he keeps doing it, I don't know how much more attention he will receive.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
With the 15th anniversary of 9/11 coming up on Sunday, we want to look now at how that day affected the rest of the world. Joining us from London is Lise Doucette, the BBC's chief international correspondent. Lise, welcome back to you.
Always nice to be back.
And we're also joined here by Rami Khoury, who is a senior policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. Rami, great to see you as well.
Good to be with you.
And let me start with you, Rami. How do you think that the anniversary of 9/11 resonates in the Middle East?
You know, I don't think the anniversary as such is a particular marker in the Middle East as it is for people here. But what is troubling for most people in the Middle East is the broad trends that they've experienced in the last 15 years continue those trends which they experienced before. The global war on terror, which was sparked by 9/11, has dramatically increased political repression, the rule of autocrats, militarism, and all of the underlying trends in the region, population growth, job, economic problems, environmental problems, disparity between poor and rich. All of those trends have worsened, but they were worsening before 9/11. So 9/11 isn't quite the marker for us in the Arab world and the Middle East as it is for the West, except for the heightened militarism that came with the global war on terror and the explicit support for autocratic dictators in the Arab world.
Lise, you're in London now, but of course you've spent a lot of time in the Middle East in countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan. How do you think that this anniversary resonates?
I think the 9/11 so-called has underlined the point that it's not an event which can change the world. It's the response to event that does it. And I think it is more the consequences of 9/11 that are still resonating across the world in some ways that are very good and in some ways which are absolutely catastrophic. If we look, for example, at Afghanistan, of course, 9/11 led to the war, to the invasion of Afghanistan, which led to the toppling of the Taliban and created what was felt by Afghans to be their best chance of peace in as long as anyone can remember. And that created for that young generation, just in their teens at the time of 9/11, they got the scholarships to the West. They got the jobs created by the military intervention, which started building up the new aid programs that flooded into Afghanistan. But it also bred more militancy. The Taliban, which had been not defeated but pushed into Pakistan, then rose again. So 9/11 is still felt all these years on. You have a country now which is still being fractured. And those who benefited from 9/11, if I can say that, in the sense of that Afghanistan became a different kind of a country, are now fleeing or struggling to survive and to hold on to their dreams. And the militants are back with ever greater force. And briefly, I would say in the Middle East, because 9/11 was exploited by the Bush administration, which sought not about Afghanistan and Pakistan, which were the heartland of al-Qaeda then, but because it was about Iraq, we saw the invasion of Iraq, and Rami Khoury knows so much that has stemmed from what has many of the problems and crises and figures, leading figures in so-called Islamic State and al-Qaeda in the region that we're seeing came right out of what happened after the invasion of Iraq in 2003 with the mismanagement of Iraq after the invasion, the American prisons, the militancy that spawned, and so on and so forth.
Well, Rami, now that we look at the major crises in the Middle East, including Syria and also in North Africa, in Libya, would any of these things have happened? Would the Arab Spring have happened if it hadn't been for what the U.S. did after 9/11 in going into Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, the Arab Spring certainly would have happened. We'd had many sort of trial runs of the Arab Spring, people rising up against their leaders or against foreign occupations in Iraq and Lebanon and Sudan and many other places around the region. So the Arab Spring was an inevitability. The question of the repercussions of 9/11 and the response, as Lise correctly says, it's the response of the world powers that has accelerated the negative trends which were already happening because of the incompetence, the corruption, the autocracy, and the brutality of regimes all across the Middle East. But the one striking thing about 9/11 that is a marker for us in the region is that it marked the coming of age of groups like Al-Qaeda, which were then followed by ISIS and others, many smaller groups, and the shifting of the global jihad, as they call it, from Afghanistan, Pakistan to Syria now. Syria is now the center of the global jihad, or Syria, northern Iraq.
Yeah.
We'll see if that continues or if they dissipate again and go to other countries. But the continued growth of Salafi, Takfiri, jihadi militants like Qaeda, like ISIS, like others, that has been one of the striking developments in recent years, with support among populations across the region that is numbered in the millions of people.
And Lise, back then in 2001, the U.S. did not obviously have adequate attention being put on the threat from Al-Qaeda, the threat from terrorism, but it seems that as the global attention has been paid to the threat of terrorism, it's only gotten worse.
Well, that's the tragic irony of 9/11. Don't forget, 9/11 was a time, I don't know whether we can say it is the moment, but it was the reinforcing of the, for your, as Bush would say, you're either for us
right.
or against us. It, the other, everyone started asking in the United States and beyond, who's our enemy? Who are these Muslims? Is this Islam? What about Christianity? Can we live together? The us and them, the people who are among us and people who are against us, there's been a deepening and a darkening of that sort of that binary view of the world ever since. And until we arrive now in 2016, where we have the huge migration crisis, the backlash, the rise of far right wing groups, the us and them is much, much more dangerous a dynamic in our world today.
Rami, what do you think the world has learned post 9/11?
I think some people have learned that you need to look at the underlying problems and solve them. Otherwise, you're never going to have stability and peace. The problem is not many people have learned that, and almost nobody in power in the Western world or in the Arab world has learned that lesson. But a lot of ordinary people have, and this is one of the interesting things now, the strong populist local movements all across the Arab world, people trying to push their systems to reform, to change, to become more equitable, more responsive, more participatory and pluralistic. They haven't had a breakthrough except in Tunisia, but this is what we should keep our eye on in the next 10 years.
I wouldn't say the lessons of 9/11, but something really struck me at the time, and I will call it the challenge of 9/11. 9/11 then provoked meetings around the world, summits, where leaders came together, and it was usually George Bush and Tony Blair and Hamid Karzai, the new leader of Afghanistan, and various others, who would stand together and say, we are standing shoulder to shoulder and saying to Afghanistan, we are with you for the long run. And I remember thinking at the time, what does the long run mean to Western governments? And we soon found out. For the United States, it was only a matter of years before they diverted resources and troops and attention to Iraq. For other NATO armies, it was a decade, and then they looked elsewhere. And such that about a decade on, my question then became, what is it about our time that when men and women of goodwill, much resources, many troops, cannot get together and put countries back together again? Is it because they don't know how to do it, or is it because they don't want to do it? These, for me, have been the questions that came out of 9/11. If that kind of an event cannot provoke men and women of goodwill and resources around the world to work in different ways, then my question is, what will it take?
Well, Rami, what is the long run, do you think? How long is the U.S. going to have to fight the battle that started on 9/11?
Well, every single one of the major problems or constraints in the Middle East, and the Arab world in particular, 15 years ago is now much, much worse. And therefore, the dissatisfaction, the desperation of tens of millions of people. You're talking about 400 million Arabs, of whom around 200 million really have very difficult lives. And this is the big challenge now. How do you allow these societies and these countries to stabilize and give their citizens a sense that the world is going to improve, that they don't need to do illegal migration, they don't need to do political violence, they don't have to join corrupt groups. So the long run is really a question of political reform on a serious level. The really scary thing is that nobody in the West and nobody in the Arab world is talking about these issues. Therefore, the next 10, 15 years are going to be very turbulent in our region until some movement from within takes hold and people start reforming and stabilizing their societies. It's not going to happen from leaders from outside, and it's not going to happen from the current crop of leaders.
That's Rami Khoury, a senior policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. We've also been speaking with Lise Doucette, the BBC's chief international correspondent. Thanks to both of you.
Glad to be with you.
And it's been a rough fire season in California. Just this year, the state has seen more than 4,400 fires, 1,000 more than usual. And one of those, the Erskine Fire in Southern California, earlier this summer, destroyed more than 250 homes, a grim reminder that many live in harm's way. That threat's likely to grow as California's population increases and more houses are built near fire-prone areas. Sandon Totten of KPCC takes a look at the latest thinking on how to keep those homes safe.
Architect Don Ross is shuffling through maps in the back of his truck.
We are right here.
He points to a small neighborhood in La Crescenta known as Briggs Terrace. It's a dense pocket of homes in between two fire-prone hillsides just above the Sierra Madre Fault, with only one road going in and out. His biggest fear? An earthquake that cuts off the road and sparks a wildfire.
It all works together to create a soup of hazards, for lack of a better phrase.
A soup of hazards.
this area has the most hazards.
Ross is a volunteer with La Crescenta's Fire Safe Council. It's a group that helps at-risk communities like Briggs Terrace guard against disaster. He gives me a tour of the neighborhood, pointing out homes along the way that are hardened against fire.
Notice he's got fire-resistant exterior wall material.
That means these homes were built or retrofitted to be fire-safe. They have stucco walls instead of wood, fire-resistant roofing, screens on attic vents, and fire-retardant decks. In a fire-prone area like Briggs Terrace, building codes mandate that all new or remodeled homes adhere to these sorts of standards. But Ross says many of the homes here are decades old, built before these modern codes. There are examples just down the street from the newer fire-ready homes.
I see all these houses with all this wood. This is like eek. But they're older, and you can see shrubs growing right up against houses. You can see some trees that aren't limbed, and there's a lot of fire hazards.
He said unless these homeowners plan to do significant new work on their exteriors, they won't be forced to make changes. That puts them and their neighbors in danger, since a house fire can burn a long time, allowing the blaze to spread more easily to other homes. Alexandra Seifert is a researcher with the Conservation Biology Institute, and she thinks about home fire hazards like these a lot. And I mean a lot.
I have a fire playlist on Spotify.
Like, what's on it?
We've got Ring of Fire, Johnny Cash, Santa Ana Winds by the Cold War Kids, House Burning Down by Hendrix.
Seifert's spent a lot of time studying the popular fireproofing technique known as defensible space. That's the idea that people should clear trees and shrubs directly around their homes and keep larger plants to a minimum for a distance of 100 feet or more. Some experts even suggest mowing down plants for up to 200 feet around homes. But Seifert has studied hundreds of burned houses from past wildfires and found that people may actually be clearing too much.
Within the first 50 to 60 feet, there is a significant chance that it will reduce your risk of burning in a fire. Anything beyond 100 feet provides no significant additional benefit.
She means the chances of avoiding fire don't significantly increase with clearing beyond 100 feet. Seifert also says clearing too many native plants and shrubs can actually increase fire danger by giving non-native grasses an opportunity to spread.
And when embers land on evergreen shrublands, they're much more likely to just go out. When they land on a dry grassland, that's just tinder.
Still, she says research suggests the number one way to keep homes safe from fire is to stop building them in wild areas. People are by far the number one cause of fire in Southern California. With the region's population expected to jump by 4 million over the next several decades, that threat will rise. But trends suggest we'll keep expanding into more formerly wild areas.
I think elected officials would be very reluctant to tell someone who had property that they couldn't put a home on it.
That's Thomas Scott, a natural resource specialist based at UC Riverside. He says unlike federal laws stopping people from building in certain flood zones and state laws stopping construction on known quake faults, no such laws exist for keeping people out of fire-prone areas. Scott says that's partly because fire zones are so common and so much of California is already built out.
The question would be, in the coast ranges of California or in the Sierra foothills, would there actually be an opportunity to say the kind of fire that will come up this canyon will be too severe to fight, so we can't have houses there?
Insurance companies can charge more for structures in fire-prone areas. And the state sticks some rural homeowners with fees to help cover fire prevention costs. But even that's been controversial. Don Ross with the Law Crescenta Fire Safe Council thinks rules on where you can and can't build aren't the answer.
It doesn't really matter where the edge is. There's going to be an edge between the urban and wild. And I'm very big on property rights. I'm very big on adults making decisions for themselves as long as they're informed decisions.
Ross says he and others will keep informing those decisions and working hard to make sure those in harm's way have a fighting chance against fire. For Here and Now, I'm Sandon Totten in Los Angeles.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.